He holds the Henry Summitt Professorship in Theoretical Physics at the City College of New York, and is a graduate and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. He has lectured around the world, and his PhD level textbooks are required reading at many of the top physics labs. Dr. Kaku graduated from Harvard in 1968, summa cum laude, and number one in his physics class. He received a PhD from the University of California at Berkeley Radiation Lab in 1972, held a lectureship at Princeton University in 73, joined the faculty at the City University of New York, where he's been a professor of theoretical physics for 25 years. His goal is to help complete Einstein's dream of a theory of everything. That would be a single equation, perhaps, as he likes to say, no more than an inch long about your thumb, which will unify all the fundamental forces in the universe. His current book, new book, is Parallel Worlds. And God, it's interesting. He starts out, when I was a child, I had a personal conflict over my beliefs. My parents were raised in the Buddhist tradition, but I attended Sunday school every week, where I loved hearing the biblical stories about whales, arks, pillars of salt, ribs, and apples. I was fascinated by these Old Testament parables, which were my favorite part of Sunday school. It seemed to me that the parables about great floods, burning bushes, and parting waters were so much more exciting than Buddhist chanting and meditation. In fact, these ancient tales of heroism and tragedy vividly illustrated deep moral and ethical lessons which have stayed with me all my life. One day in Sunday school, we studied Genesis to read about God thundering from the heavens. "Let there be light" sounded so much more dramatic than silently meditating about nirvana. Out of naive curiosity, I asked my Sunday school teacher, "Did God have a mother?" She usually had a rather snappy answer, as well as a deep moral lesson to offer. This time, however, she was taken aback. "No," she replied hesitantly, "God probably did not have a mother, but then where did God come from?" I asked. She mumbled that she'd, well, have to consult with the minister about that one. I didn't realize that I had accidentally stumbled into one of the great questions of theology. I was puzzled because in Buddhism, there is no God at all, but a timeless universe instead with no beginning or end. Later, when I began to study the great mythologies of the world, I learned that there were two types of cosmologies in religion. The first based in a single moment when God created the universe. The second based on the idea the universe always was and always will be. They couldn't both be right, I thought. Later, I began to find that these common themes cut across many other cultures. In Chinese mythology, for example, in the beginning there was a cosmic egg. The infant Pon Ku resided for almost an eternity in the egg, which floated on a formless sea of chaos. When it finally hatched, Pon Ku grew enormously over 10 feet per day, so the top half of the eggshell became the sky and the bottom the earth. After 18,000 years, he died to give birth to our world. His blood became the rivers, his eyes the sun, moon, and his voice the thunder. Just a little taste, and boy, I'll tell you what, if you like that, you're gonna love this book called Parallel Worlds by Dr. Michio Kaku, who will be here in a moment. Stay right there. Professor Michio Kaku, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be on the show again, Art. It's been a while.
It's been a while and too long, and I'm just very pleased to have you here. We have a number of things to talk about, but I want to ask a question.
Yes?
When my wife passed away, there was a Catholic priest there, thank God, who gave her last rites, and then I had an opportunity. He stayed with me for a number of hours, and we talked of many things, of course. I was kind of in a fog, a state of shock, but he said something that I responded to. He said, aren't, I guess it's a standard line. He said, look around you. Look around you. Look at the flowers and the trees and the oceans and the sun and the moon and all those things that have to be here for us. It has to be so perfect. And if any one of these things weren't just so, the human being wouldn't be here. So even down from the smallest seed and flower and the smallest speck of anything that we can detect, everything has to be absolutely perfect. And so there has to be a God, was his contention, for everything to be this perfect. Well, even in my shocked condition, I came back at him and I said, well, yeah, that's certainly one way to look at it. Oh, great. I've got an alarm going off and no way to turn it off. So I'm gonna put this down and go try to turn it off. And maybe you can take a moment and try and explain to me, Professor, which it is you believe. Whether you think everything was so perfect and put here by God, or whether, well, it had to be this way, or we wouldn't be here.
Well, Art, you ask one of the deep questions between art and science. If you take a look at science, we have two basic paradoxical principles. One is called the Copernicus principle. The Copernican principle says that humans are not special in any particular way. That's the Copernican principle. And the more we discover about the universe, it does seem as if humans are not so special. However, there is another point of view, which has also survived every scientific challenge, and that's the anthropic principle. The anthropic principle is very simple, and that is that intelligence and life is so difficult to create, that you have to realize that, well, some people would say perhaps there's a creator, or perhaps it was a gigantic cosmic accident. Now, if you take a look at the constants of nature, for example, the mass of the proton, the charge of the electron, the lifetime of the sun, the strength of the nuclear force, you realize that they're tuned just right to make life possible. If the nuclear force were stronger, the sun would have burnt out billions of years ago, and we wouldn't be here. If the nuclear force were weaker, the sun wouldn't have ignited at all, and we still wouldn't be here. If gravity were a little bit stronger, we would have had a big crunch, and the universe would have collapsed billions of years ago. If gravity were a little bit weaker, then we would have had a big freeze, and we'd all be frozen to death right now. So you realize that the laws of nature are tuned very precisely to make life possible in the universe.
So you, I'll tell you what, Professor, hold on just a sec. I've got to tell my audience, and then we're going to pursue this. I got to tell you guys what happened. I guess some gentleman in Oregon took what I had to say in the first hour and called the sheriff's department here in Pahrump and said that I was in a bad way. So the reason the alarm went off is because two deputies from the sheriff's department came to my door and said, you know, doing a welfare check. And they are the ones who set off the alarm. So I had to just go to the door and explain to those nice officers that I'm in the middle of doing a radio program, and honestly, I am okay. So please don't anybody else do that. I'm all right. I Will Survive is the name of the song. Anyway, that's what just happened. So you heard the alarm go off, and then there was a knock at the door, and I explained to the nice officers that I am just fine. Now, Professor Kaku, back to the interview.
Mm-hmm.
This is live radio, man. This stuff happens, I guess.
Okay.
Recap for me. It would be your position then, Professor, that everything that we experience in the world, being so perfect, is that way because it has to be that way, or we wouldn't be here.
Well, that is sort of the essence of the anthropic principle.
Uh-huh.
Which is gaining a lot of credibility among string theorists, for example, which simply says that perhaps the universe was tuned very precisely to make us possible. Now, when I was a kid in second grade, my second grade teacher told me that God so loved the earth that he put the earth just right from the sun. Not too close, not too far.
Right.
If the earth were too close, the oceans would have boiled. If the earth were too far, the oceans would have frozen. Well, I was quite shocked being in second grade because that was the first time I'd ever heard of this principle that life is just right to make us all possible. The earth, the formation of the sun, the solar system is tuned just right to make life possible.
But that sounds as though there was someone doing the tuning.
Right. However, now we've discovered 150 extrasolar planets orbiting other star systems where these planets are too close, they are too far, they are frozen, their waters did evaporate, and they're lifeless as far as we can tell. Now, when you talk about the universe seems to be tuned just right to make life possible.
Yes.
The nuclear force, the electromagnetic force, the gravitational force, all of them are just right to make life possible.
Tuned by intelligence, Professor, or tuned by winning the lottery, the cosmic lottery? And having
That's the whole ball of wax, isn't it? Either there is a God who loved our universe so much that he put our universe just right so that we have mild temperatures and a universe that is long enough to create DNA and so on and so forth, or there are other universes. Or there are dead universes where the sun never ignited, or universes where the stars burn out very rapidly, universes where the universe expands so rapidly that everything gets cold, or universes where the universe collapses to a big crunch and everything dies in fire. So in my book, Parallel Worlds, I lay out the fact that in string theory, the theory that I work on, we have a problem that we have many solutions of string theory. All of them seem to be self-consistent mathematically, and so we have this problem. Perhaps the way to choose our universe is that our universe is the only one that allows for life. All the other ones are dead universes, universes that consist of lightning bolts, universes that consist of photons, light beams, but no DNA, no living matter. So in other words, our universe could be quite special among all possible universes. We now believe in something called a multiverse. A multiverse is an ocean of parallel universes. Think of soap bubbles.
All right, but again, Professor, back to the question that you agreed was the whole ball of wax. And I guess I just want to know what you believe. Is it your belief that everything, in fact, is so perfect because it had to be because we won the cosmic lottery? Do you believe that, or do you believe that there is a God's hand in the formation of everything that is admittedly so perfect?
Well, right now, I'm an agnostic on that question. But I kind of lean toward the idea of a cosmic lottery.
I had a feeling.
The universe is tuned very precisely. It didn't have to be this way. The universe could have been random, chaotic. It could have been a mess. The universe is tuned very precisely to allow for mild temperatures, DNA, and life to get off the ground. That's very difficult. I try to create a universe in the morning when I wake up and I try to play with different equations. And I realize it's quite difficult to create our universe. Our universe is tuned very precisely.
Well, you keep using that word, and the implication of that word is that there was a hand doing the tuning.
Well,
but that isn't what you believe, is it?
They also have been a crapshoot, too.
You seem to believe the cosmic lottery theory, that it just all turned out right, and therefore here we are.
That's right, because if it didn't turn out right, we wouldn't be here to talk about it to begin with. There may be dead universes consisting of dead matter and no life. However, if this theory is correct, it also means that there are other universes that are just like ours, except for one cosmic tiny difference, one cosmic ray that separates us from another universe. If a cosmic ray went through Hitler's mother, for example, then Hitler may never have been born. The mother may have had a miscarriage. It only takes one cosmic ray to create a miscarriage. Or what happens if that cosmic ray went through Churchill's mother?
How convinced are you there are other universes where there are subtle but important differences in the way the world is proceeding?
Well, this gets us into what is called many worlds theory. In quantum theory, which of course is the architecture for all of our existence, all of electronics is made possible by the quantum theory. Mm-hmm. In the quantum theory, we have this bizarre paradox that cats can be dead and alive simultaneously, both
yes.
dead and alive simultaneously.
Uh-huh.
In which case, perhaps you're in one universe, your wife is still alive. And one cosmic ray could separate us from a world where some of our loved ones are still alive. And like I said, just one cosmic ray separates us from a world where we're all speaking German.
Well, not too much really separates you from, I don't know, the concept of a creator. As I listen to your words, it's sort of there, but when pressed, it's not there. I don't know. There's two parts to you, aren't there?
Well, I'm an agnostic on that question. my attitude is I go where the data and where the equations take me,
wherever they are. That's like the scientific version of no comment.
Well, I'm open.
Taking the fifth.
You see, some people, there's something called the giggle factor. When you ask a scientist about flying saucers, about God, about evil and stuff like that, their reaction is basically to giggle. I don't believe in giggling. I believe that we should take some of these questions very, very seriously. And we shouldn't simply, snicker like unfortunately some of my friends do.
Uh-oh.
And I think it's, very disrespectful, and it's very close-minded to simply giggle or snicker.
Because it is possible that there is a creator.
It is possible. It is possible that there is life in outer space. It is possible that we're not alone. And these are real, legitimate scientific questions. So, unfortunately, I think that a lot of scientists tend to retreat rather than try to engage the public.
Well, you want to talk about giggle factors. Yes, it's possible we're not alone. It's even possible, for example, that we're being observed. It's even possible that the people who see these craft that are not possible with the technology we know we have or anywhere close, that, it's conceivable, Professor, that we are being visited.
Right. And I think a correct scientific attitude is to try to, test some of these theories. And I should point out that in 2008, in just 2 years' time, we may be able to settle many of these questions when the Kepler probe goes into outer space. It's scheduled for launch in June of 2008.
And its mission?
Its mission is to find Earth-like planets, twins of the Earth in outer space.
Wow.
Not dead Jupiter-sized planets that are too close, that are too far from the sun, but planets that are just right in the Goldilocks zone, as we say.
If I've got this right, the Kepler probe, I believe it's called, is only going to go out and try and detect Earth-like planets. In other words, not traverse space to them, but only detect them. Is that right, Professor?
That's right. It may take perhaps another century before we get enough technology to send a probe to the nearest stars. However, the Kepler probe, in just 2 years, will scan about 100,000 stars.
By what means will it scan?
It has a telescope by which it looks at dimming of starlight. When starlight dims a little,
a planet's going in front of it.
That's called the transit. Not a total eclipse, but a dimming of the light because the planet goes in front of the face of the star.
Got it. All right. Well, how will this probe be able to detect very much more than, say, telescopes on Earth, which have, I believe, detected that already?
No, these are transits caused by Earth-like planets. That's the whole key. We've discovered 150 Jupiter-sized planets orbiting other stars.
No, but what I'm asking is, what additional power does this probe have above and beyond Earth-based
telescope? Well, it's in outer space where you don't have problems of scattering of light and thermal currents and blurring.
Here, but wouldn't you also have that the moment you left the atmosphere? I mean, in the space station, for example.
That's right. You could put this satellite pretty much on any platform up there in outer space. Huh. But the Kepler is one that's specifically designed to scan 100,000 stars, and hopefully it'll get about 600 Earth-like planets identified in outer space.
God, that would be exciting.
And that'll cause an existential shock when people look up at the night sky and feel very romantic and feel very cosmic,
yes,
realizing that here, over there, over here, all of them may have twins, virtual twins of the Earth, perhaps with liquid oceans, because they are in the Goldilocks zone, which mm-hmm. is just right to have liquid water. Liquid water, in turn, is the universal solvent in which DNA gets off the ground. And so we may have an existential shock realizing that there are twins, and that when we look in the sky at night, somebody else could be looking back at us.
Well, I'm not going to be shocked at all. But there are a lot of people who think that life is very rare. In fact, so rare that, frankly, we have not yet connected with anybody at the SETI level. We've not received the real signal yet, as far as I know. And these people can make a fairly strong case. Got to make you wonder, anyway, that there might not be others. Life may be so rare that maybe we're it.
Yeah, I don't believe that. If you have a bunch of ants in the country and they're trying to observe workers building a 10-lane superhighway next door,
yes,
the ants wouldn't have the foggiest clue as to which frequencies, what modes by which to analyze the presence of workers working right next to their anthill.
Well, SETI says, look, it'll be near hydrogen. That's a marker.
Yeah, but I think that's the stupidest thing to do. It's like the blind man who looks for a key under a lamp because that's the only place he can look. A person who's nearsighted, the only place he can look for a lost key is under a lamp at night because that's the only place that's illuminated. The key could have fallen someplace else, but he only looks where things are visible.
Well, sure, but still, isn't it a logical assumption for them to be making that the signal would be sent near this wonderful hydrogen marker because it's just so outstanding?
I think it's logical for a primitive civilization like ours to look that way.
Really?
I think it's quite logical, but I think an advanced civilization would just have a big laugh thinking that, oh my God, they're so primitive, they had to communicate at the hydrogen frequencies.
I doubt Seth Shostak is laughing right now. He probably doesn't want to hear this at all.
Yeah, well, I've talked to him, and I mentioned the fact that, real aliens would not broadcast on the hydrogen frequencies.
Well, you weren't laughing like that when you said it. Were you?
In some sense, I was, yeah.
I see.
And he laughed back, and he says, but what else can we do? You know,
isn't that a fair retort? What else can he do? Well, of course, they're looking now at, I think, light and some other things that they hadn't been previously. So they're beginning to do a few other things.
Yeah, if they had a bigger budget, they would start to look at other frequencies. They would start to look for example, the presence of laser communications in outer
yes.
space.
Yeah, I think they're underway with that.
For laser light in outer space.
I think the beginnings of that are underway and that SETI is looking at that.
Yeah, but the budget is so tiny. I mean, Seth himself admitted that he's limited by the constraints of his minuscule budget.
Mm.
So I'm not surprised at all that they've detected nothing.
Well, since this is such a big damn question, I mean, it really is a gigantic question. If we were to come in contact with others, it would be the story of, you know, since Christ was here, it would be the biggest story, certainly, and
sure.
And we're devoting so little money to it. Why do you think that is?
Oh, well, it's this giggle factor again.
Oh, but I'm not giggling. I doubt many are giggling about this. It's almost like, well, it's not quite getting the answer about God, but, it's up there.
Oh, yeah, definitely, it's up there. Mark, one of the biggest turning points, since we left the forest. But, you know, you talk to a person in Congress, and they're just going to, their eyes are going to glaze over.
Huh.
Which is, very sad. The SETI budget, if anything, they depend on handouts.
Handouts.
So, of course, they haven't found anything yet. I mean, their budget is so limited. And, you know, as I also mentioned, any intelligent species is going to change the frequencies, spread their signal out over many frequencies. You know, the universe is quite noisy, and they would have spread signal technology, whereby they would spread the signal over many frequencies.
Sure.
And then assemble it, reassemble it at the other end.
Spread,
and that's what your
spectrum.
Email does. Your email is split into many pieces, and it's reassembled at the other end.
Yeah, spread spectrum.
Yeah, and however, you know, they're not capable of analyzing spread spectrum messages.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
They don't know exactly how the messages are cut up and reassembled. Is it a Fourier transform or what?
We could be hearing it actually now and, of course, not even know it.
We could be listening to all these cosmic conversations that we would be totally clueless. It would appear as to us as gibberish. Just like if you intercept email, it appears as gibberish because you're only looking at one piece of an email, which is spread out over many cities. You'd be listening to nonsense. And so, of course, we're just going to be listening to nonsense because we could be listening to the tiniest piece.
So is it your view we probably are listening to nonsense, that there's a lot of it out there and we just are looking in all the wrong places with not enough instruments and money to buy them?
That's right. Like I said, you know, ants trying to listen in on human conversations wouldn't know the frequencies. They're being bombarded by all the vibrations and noise from workers next door, but they're clueless because they're listening to the wrong frequencies. They don't know how to process the information. And so I think just like ants cannot detect the presence of humans.
Okay, you've described many times different forms of civilization, one, two, three, and then, of course, here we are, haven't made one yet, right?
We're type zero. That's
okay,
right.
Type zero. So is it or is it not reasonable? I mean, you've already sort of jumped to the proposition that there probably are many instances of life out there. Isn't it probable they would, some of them, certainly be ahead of us in a type one or two even?
Well, I think the chances are that they're not going to be exactly at our level. Like in Star Trek, for example, all civilizations are within about 100 years of each other. The probability of that happening is astronomically small.
Well, except for Q.
Romulans are almost exactly technologically advanced.
Well, don't forget Q. You can't throw out Q.
Yeah, well, Q would be type 4, I think.
Right. He's way out there. So
yeah,
they did. I mean, not everything was within 100 years of them. But for the most part, you're correct.
Yeah, the only thing separating these species is a cloaking device. otherwise, they're all identical.
Yes.
They all have different nose makeup.
Okay, so you think there's probably a bunch of them out there.
That are separated by millions of years in technology.
Certainly,
millions
but some of them with quite a bit of technology, probably more than ours, as many with less than ours, just as many more than ours, and some of them much more than ours. And so I guess I'm working up to this kind of question. We see so much in our skies. Do you give a little bit of credence to the possibility that, well, yes, they're out there, and yes, they're monitoring us for some reason?
Well, you can't dismiss it. I've looked at a lot of UFO stuff. People email me stuff. Oh, and by the way, I should mention that my website contains my email address. It's mkaku.org, mkaku.org. And we're also setting up an online journal. My webmaster, Corey, is setting up an online journal where people can subscribe and get the very latest information about these kinds of things.
Okay.
So anyway, it is certainly possible that an intelligent species could be monitoring us. And it's certainly, you know, there's nothing in the laws of physics that says that it's impossible that we're being observed.
All right. Well, then here's a kind of a casual observation for you. Modern ufology really began about when we exploded the atomic bomb.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that could be, of course, just simple, pure coincidence. But I don't much believe in coincidences of that magnitude particularly. And, we exploded an atomic bomb, and then we started seeing these things. So, sound logical?
Oh, well, if you saw the movie 2001, it's based on the premise that a civilization making the transition between type 0 to type 1 becomes interesting and, in some sense, worthy of contact when, in the movie, they reached the moon and they made contact with this monolith, that's when the aliens realized that, yes, humans have arrived. They're type 1. They have an operating moon base. We are about 100 years away from that technology. Arthur C. Clarke was, I think, off by about 100 years. It's not going to be 2001. It'll be 2100 when we have an operating moon base capable of scanning the entire moon for the presence of a monolith. And the whole purpose of that monolith was to make contact with a type 1 civilization.
That's very depressing that it's going to be that long until we get a base on the moon.
About 100 years, I think, before we have an operating base capable of detecting anomalies like that on the moon, like in the movie. And that means that we are now interesting, worthy of some kind of contact.
By the way,
those civilizations are probably dime a dozen, and they self-destruct.
Yes. By the way, just for fun, how likely is it, how good a scenario is it that there would be something like that perhaps buried on our moon?
Well, I personally think that if there is concrete presence of extraterrestrial visitation, it will probably be as an artifact left on the moon. If I was a passing Type 3 civilization scanning thousands and thousands of planets, I'm not going to send Captain Kirk to visit each one. It would take him thousands of years to do that. I would send robotic probes, self-replicating von Neumann probes, like a virus. A virus lands on a cell and hijacks the cell and makes copies of itself. So the probe would land on the moon, build a factory, which would then send thousands of other probes to other moons. Moons are stable. They don't have erosion or wind or water, and so they're quite stable. And then these probes would simply sit there, do nothing, and just wait for the presence of a Type 0 civilization to become Type 1. Type 0 civilizations are probably dime a dozen, and they self-destruct rather frequently. So they're not really worth monitoring that much because they're not permanent. By the time you're Type 1, you become interesting. You're planetary. You have planetary music, planetary culture, planetary art, planetary mathematics. You become interesting. And so,
but as things move along in evolution, wouldn't that moment when an atomic bomb detonates be a kind of marker?
That's right. I think the detonation of atomic bomb would signal the fact that a civilization is approaching Type 1 status. And if a probe is sitting there for a million years waiting for an intelligent species to come out of the swamp and gradually rise up this sequence, then they would the first interesting signal would be a nuclear detonation, and every nuclear detonation releases a very characteristic flash called a double flash. We have a satellite up in space called the Vela satellite, which is specifically designed to look for these double flashes, which are the fingerprint of a nuclear detonation.
But we're looking back at Earth, I'm sure, right?
We're looking back at Earth,
yeah.
And it's found several nuke flashes in the past.
Quick question. Wouldn't it be useful to have a satellite out there pointed the other way looking for this double flash?
Well, a double flash on a distant star or a distant planet would be too faint to pick up. Our satellites, like the Vela, can definitely pick up double flashes on the Earth.
Okay.
And it has picked up, signals of a unauthorized detonation of a nuclear device on the Earth. But in outer space, they're just too far away. We can just barely make out the presence of Jupiter-sized planets in outer space. But the point is that as a Type 0 civilization begins to make the transition to Type 1, that would be very one noticeable signal that it is nearing Type 1 status.
Okay, that was my whole point. I mean, modern ufology was born just when that happened, and you think that's a coincidence?
Well, it's hard to say, but all I'm saying is that the probability is that the most likely place to find evidence for visitation is on the moon, because of the fact that they're ideal places to simply observe, the rise and fall of Type 0 civilizations.
Well, here's another one for you. If a very advanced alien civilization detected, an atomic bomb going off, and then hydrogen bombs, and they'd begin really looking. And we did plenty of, above ground testing to give them
That's
lots
right.
of examples, right?
Right.
might they not regard such behavior as not worthy? In other words, that maybe they're out there looking just for civilizations that develop in some peaceful way.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, gee, our detonating these monsters.
Up to 80 megatons.
Definitely might have said, you know, sent another message. Mm-hmm. And their reaction to that could be, and why wouldn't it be, these people cannot be let loose.
Well, it's conceivable. Many science fiction stories are based on that fact.
Uh-huh.
The point is that Type Zero civilizations are probably still quite savage. They're just coming out of the swamp. They have all the signs of the savagery of the swamp, you know, fundamentalism and sectarianism and racial strife. You know, by the time you're Type 1, you are planetary.
Professor, maybe you can answer where we are. If there was a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being when you made Type 1, where are we on that scale, roughly?
Well, Carl Sagan tried to answer that question. He put us at 0.7.
0.7. Yeah. And you?
Well, he did his calculation on the basis of energy production. A full Type 1 civilization can utilize all the light coming from the sun. All light coming from the sun. And you realize that we only take a tiny fraction of the light coming from the sun.
I'll say.
And utilize it.
I'll say.
A Type 1 civilization, by definition, utilizes all the light coming from the sun. And if you think about it, we're about 100, 200 years away from being able to produce energy on that scale. That is, the scale of all the light that hits your planet. And so on that scale, Carl Sagan calculated, we're about a 0.7.